Hi, Marco Werman here. You know my voice from the show, but what you don't often hear are the voices who work behind the scenes. Many talented people bring you the world each day. If you've ever wondered who makes our show, come meet us at theworld.org/whoweare. You'll see the superhero staff that makes the world what it is. The World's Newsroom digs deep into every story, takes risks, and shines a light on the communities most impacted by the headlines. Please take a moment to meet our staff. You'll find us at theworld.org/whoweare. And while you're there, you can also make a difference today in the work that we do by donating $100 or more. That's just $8.33 a month. Your gift can help us keep the show accessible to everybody. Help us make our goal, $100,000 from at least 1,000 donors, and you'll receive a personal invite to a virtual party with the incredible people who make the show. Once again, visit theworld.org/whoweare to learn about our team and donate today. From everybody here at The World, thanks. Many Americans are tired of restrictions. In parts of Europe, though, you need government permission to leave the house.
Start a text to this government number. I put the number 6, first last name, and my address.
And boom, you're approved to go out jogging. Also today, lands controlled by Armenia are handed over to Azerbaijan, but this Armenian priest is not going anywhere.
Every single church is important for us.
For him, the buildings are evidence that Armenia has been there for a long time. And Soviet chess culture, we put authenticity in check on the Queen's Gambit with Garry Kasparov.
Even the big concert halls where we played that could bring in up to 2,000 people, that were not big enough.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Americans, please do not travel for Thanksgiving. That is a repeated plea from public health officials, a plea that is largely being ignored. Air travel in the U.S. is now at its highest level since March. In other parts of the world, staying put isn't simply a request. Strict lockdowns are preventing movement. The World's Lydia Manalidou joins me now from Greece, where movement is severely restricted. What are the rules in Greece right now, Lydia?
Yeah, so Marco, we went into a second lockdown earlier this month, and at the time, cases here in Greece were at an all-time high. Our ICUs were nearly at capacity. And right now, everything except the essential places are closed. So schools are closed, stores are closed, gyms, bars, it's all closed. No movement is allowed between 9 p.m. and 5 a.m. unless it's for work reasons and you have a special paper. And then if you want to leave your house at any moment, you have to text the government and get permission.
How does that work? Like just on your cell phone, I guess.
Yeah, so there are 6 reasons you're allowed to go out for, and they each have a number. So for example, number 1 is going to the pharmacy or doctor. Number 2 is going to the grocery store. Number 3 is going to the bank. Say I want to go exercise, that's number 6. So what I'll do is I'll take out my phone and I'll start a text to this government number. I put the number 6, first last name, and my address. And then right away, I get a response that I can go out. So this process is automated. It's not like there's somebody at the other end reading through these and giving approval. But the idea is that if there are too many people from the same zip code requesting to go out at the same time, that you won't get a text back and therefore you won't be allowed to go out. Now, when you do go out, you have to bring your phone with you and your ID in case you get stopped by police. You have to show that you did indeed get approval to move. And if you don't, you get fined 300 euros. And there are police right now basically everywhere, stationed all over the country to do this. And even if you do have permission to go out, there are still a lot of restrictions. Like say you want to go out to exercise, you're only allowed to be with one other person. And you can only move within your neighborhood. So I'm not allowed to leave the vicinity of my house, and certainly I'm not allowed to leave my municipality. And if I do, I'll be fined.
What are officials saying about the system of lockdowns and letting the government know where they are? Is it working to help the country get a grip on tracking people and maybe stemming the virus?
This same scheme was in place in the spring when we went into our first lockdown. We were actually one of the very first countries to go into lockdown and to have such a strict lockdown. And it really worked the first time. And so I think people are hoping that it works this time around, too, and that the number of new cases and the number of deaths can drop and things can go back to being a little more normal.
You know, I think of Americans who have been weighing the risks of gathering in groups for Thanksgiving. Obviously in Greece, no parallel holiday like Thanksgiving at the same time. But have there been holidays that meant Greeks could not travel? And how did they react to that?
Yeah, so Greeks had to miss out on Greek Easter in the spring, which arguably is the biggest holiday, bigger than Christmas. People will travel back to their villages or the country where their family home is, and they'll have huge family gatherings. They'll roast lamb on a spit. They flock to the Orthodox churches and their processions and all sorts of services. And that didn't happen this year. The same travel restrictions that I mentioned, people not being allowed to leave their municipalities, those were in place. And so police had set up stations all over the country, on highways, at toll booths, and they were checking to make sure that the people who were traveling had proof that they were traveling to their place of residence. So people weren't allowed to have these big gatherings that they tend to have. And I think the sense here is that if people could get through that, if people could get through the COVID-19 version of Greek Easter, that they can get through whatever version of Christmas we get this year, too.
The World's Lydia Manalidou in Athens. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
So we're all focused on the Thanksgiving weekend, but the UK has its sights on Christmas. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said this week that Brits will be allowed to form Christmas bubbles. People from three households can get together for the holiday. In recent months, Johnson has talked a lot about saving Christmas. That phrase has also given some Brits the sense that other religions and their holidays are being overlooked. Mariam Khan is a writer and activist in the UK. Mariam, you've written about how the British government has seemed a bit tone deaf to the concerns of other religions through the pandemic. You give the example of Eid this year, the Muslim celebration at the end of Ramadan. Tell us what happened. What did you see?
You know, we weren't allowed to sort of congregate during the Ramadan period, which is like a really big period for Muslims globally. And in that period, you know, we weren't allowed to congregate in mosques. We weren't allowed to go around to people's houses to eat together, you know, because you're fasting from sunrise to sunset. And then just before Eid, the night before, for the northern region of the UK, the UK government announced that actually, no, you can't do Eid with your families. You must stay at home. And that was the night before. The equivalent that I give would be if we get to, let's say, Christmas Eve, and then the government suddenly decides, no, actually, let's not do families meeting up. You know, you've done your Christmas shop, the food's there, your family's excited. And then all of a sudden, you have the government say, absolutely not, you can't do it. And it's not just Eid. It's also, you know, Diwali that's just gone by, and many of my friends have spent that alone, even the Jewish holidays as well. Many of my friends haven't been able to see their families or congregate in their spaces of worship or just be a part of the festivities. And I don't want to be a Christmas Scrooge, and I don't want to take anyone's holiday away from them. And I can completely appreciate that people will struggle by themselves. But COVID doesn't understand that it's Christmas. It's not going to take a holiday much like we want. Mm-hmm. We all want to. It's just a sacrifice we all need to make. And it seems that that sacrifice is somehow turned into this double standard.
What about Boris Johnson's announcement on Tuesday about allowing Christmas bubbles up to three households to celebrate Christmas together? What was your response to that?
It was something that I wasn't shocked about. For me, saving Christmas per se has become this political game where Boris just really wants to be likable. And, you know, the government's done U-turn after U-turn this year on face masks, on exam results, on free school meals, on whether they're going to help people who need rent, who are privately renting, on everything. So I think what Boris really wants from this is to be light.
So Mariam, you mentioned the double standard when it comes to faith, saving Christmas, but not creating spaces for other religions' festivities. Is your concern that the British government is trying to accommodate Christians in a way that puts others at risk in terms of health?
I think that there is, you know, some sort of preferential treatment going on here. And I think that whether it's the intention or not, the positioning of that, what that's going to cause is sort of this divide or this tension between people of faith within the UK. Because much like when someone hears me speaking, they're going to be like, oh, you know, she's being a Scrooge and she really wants Christmas to be cancelled. Absolutely not. I have not seen my family in months. I do not want to wish that upon anyone. However, I appreciate that I need to make a sacrifice for you know, the greater goal of getting back to normal. And many people will say, oh, but this is the UK and this is Britain and we're a Christian society. We're a multicultural society. You know, whether you like it or not, there are many people of faith in this country. They're your fellow citizens. Every Thursday at the beginning of the lockdown, we would come out, whether we were Christians or Muslims or Jews or Hindus or, you know, whoever we were, we would come out on a Thursday and we would clap for our NHS. We would take national pride in the people who were on the front line, you know, saving people, putting their own lives in danger. I want that sort of camaraderie to come back and for people to take it from that perspective, that this really isn't about me trying to steal your Christmas joy or taking pleasure in you being away from your family. It's about how can we get out of this position that we're in.
Mariam Khan is a writer and activist. She's the editor of It's Not About the Burqa, Muslim Women on Faith, Feminism, Sexuality, and Race. Thanks very much for your thoughts today.
Thank you.
The tiny former Soviet Republic of Moldova is getting its first female president. She's a pro-Western politician who beat the pro-Russian incumbent. But as Kyle Vass reports, corruption became the issue that energized many voters, including Moldovans living abroad.
$1,400 a year. That's the average household income in Moldova. And it goes a long way to explain why one of three adults from there have left the country to go find work. Sabina Kostin became part of the Moldovan diaspora at age 17. Her family won the green card lottery and moved to Minneapolis.
Wasn't expecting the cold, but I think I'm used to it.
Kostin says one of the first things about American life that stood out to her was the fact that institutional bribery was not really a thing like in Moldova.
The way I gotten into a charter school from the very beginning, I was in second grade. I took an entrance test. It looks like I didn't fully pass it. So the next day, my mother dressed me nicely and my mom said, "How much do you need to get her in school?"
Kostin says she's not someone who's really into politics. But one candidate for president this year stood out to her, Maia Sandu. And Kostin says that's because Sandu put one thing at the center of her campaign, corruption.
This is what is at the heart of all of this. The farther we go, with more transparency, we'll be able to achieve so much more.
Maia Sandu won the election for president last week in Moldova. She defeated the incumbent Igor Dodon in a landslide. Dodon was accused of taking bribes and vowed to rule Moldova like Putin.
He has promised that Putin would visit Moldova, which has not happened in the last 4 years.
Yulia Zhoja is a professor at Georgetown University.
The fact that Russia has restrained itself from intervening actively in these elections has been very good news for the entire region.
Zhoja says there's a paradigm shift happening in Moldova. The big political question used to be, will the country look to Europe or to Russia? But now, Zhoja says many Moldovan voters care most about internal governance, transparency versus oligarchy. And she says that's especially true for the diaspora, which made up about 15% of voter turnout this year.
They see how well they fare in the West, and they want to be able to do as well at home and to be able to return home.
Zhoja says Moldovans abroad also make up the biggest foreign investors in the country. The remittances they send back home add up to about 16% of GDP. President-elect Sandu herself left Moldova to pursue an education at Harvard. She also worked at the World Bank in Washington, and so I ask her, why did you come back?
Because Moldova is a beautiful country with very nice people. I got an interesting job opportunity. It was a challenging job for me to become Minister of Education.
In that job, Sandu says she helped tackle the problem of bribery in schools. She says she considers herself lucky to be back in Moldova, and Sandu says she empathizes with the people in diaspora.
They still believe in their country. They want things to change in our country. And the proof to that is their participation in the latest presidential elections a few days ago.
Sandu got overwhelming support from Moldovans abroad. More than 90% of them voted for her.
We need to work very hard to create opportunities for them at home. First of all, to create a functional government, to have the rule of law for the people to believe in their country again.
Sandhu says that means going after systemic corruption, for example, in the judicial system.
Unfortunately, some of the existing judges are corrupt. Some of the people who are already in the system are corrupt. And I will be promoting a law in the parliament to clean up the system, to do the evaluation of judges and prosecutors.
Sandhu says she knows battling corruption is dangerous work. Her own mother has even begged her to stop because she fears for her daughter's safety. But Sandhu says the outpouring of support she's seen this year gives her the courage to lead the charge for reform, to create a country that the diaspora can come home to. As one Sandhu supporter I spoke to who lives in Austria, Natalia Kukoš, put it,
"Poți scoți omul din Moldova, dar nu poți scoți Moldova dintr-un om niciodată."
You can take the person out of Moldova, she says, but you can't take Moldova out of the person. For The World, I'm Kyle Vass.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Sometimes a gift has a way of unexpectedly circling back to the giver, like a seed that blossoms decades later. That's how Sandra Nathan describes a recent surprise she received. Nathan is a retired civil rights and labor lawyer in Steventown, New York. The story of her unexpected gift begins in Chuncheon, which in the 60s was a war-ravaged city in South Korea. Nathan traveled there in 1966 as a 21-year-old Peace Corps volunteer teaching English to high school students.
There were about 65 girls in the classroom, as there were in almost every class I taught. And there was one charcoal stove. And as the weather turned, it became increasingly cold in the classrooms. One day, I do remember several large rats running across the floor.
Today, Korea is an industrialized nation. They build cars and appliances, an economy that is light years ahead of what you experienced probably in the 60s. It was probably closer then to North Korea today.
Absolutely. The South Koreans, many of them were very poor, did not really have adequate clothing, and there were people who were starving.
Sandra, what do you remember about your students that you taught and how they dealt with the poverty all around you?
There was a young woman who seemed to be trying very hard to learn English, who was frequently absent and about whom I was quite concerned. And we did not live far from a U.S. military base, and I took her there to get medical attention to see what the problem was. It turned out she had parasites, but because the food that the Koreans were eating, or some Koreans were eating at the time, also had parasites, there was really not much the doctor could do. But in gratitude, this young student's mother brought me some, they were warm eggs with little feathers still attached to them. And I knew that my student and her mother could probably have used those eggs, but they gave them to me. And really, it brought me close to tears.
So let's move 5 decades to the present. You got a message recently asking if you'd like to receive a package from South Korea. What went through your mind when you got that message?
The message did say it was from the Korean government, and it was offering masks and other types of protection against COVID-19. And I guess I'm, you know, kind of cynical, especially after these last years in this country where we've been so divided and there's been a lot of ugliness. And I thought it was probably, you know, a good public relations opportunity for Korea since it had dealt so well in responding to the COVID epidemic. But when I brought the box into my home, it was just delivered by regular mail, I felt myself getting all teary, and I did not want to open the box because it was special in some way, and I was afraid that that special feeling would go away when I opened it.
All right, so eventually you opened it though, right?
Yes, I did. It took almost a week to open it. What the sense I had was that there was tremendous gratitude for some things that I had done 50 years earlier, which I had not myself even thought about recently, and that there was a sense of responsibility for me coming from Korea, that we're all interconnected in the world, and Korea decided that it could help other people since it had been doing well, relatively well with COVID. And that's what it did. It just reached out and I felt taken care of. And I do think that the Korean culture is truly amazing in terms of its deep sense of gratitude and generosity. And that sense is not really limited so much by time as something like that might be in our own culture.
And today, South Korea is one of the world's richest countries. It's also offering the world something of a model for how to deal with COVID-19, and it's sending these COVID survival boxes to more than 500 former Peace Corps volunteers. Why do you think South Korea's government is doing this?
I'm not sure how to describe it except in contrast to our own culture, where people are generous, but our connections with people seem to be more limited to transactions, if you will, to time, to what am I going to get for what I'm giving you.
Sandra, I just want to end with a Korean folk song that you said really brings you back to that time in your life and your years teaching in South Korea. The song is still beloved, actually, in both Koreas today. It's called Arirang. Sandra, what is this song still saying to you, as well as so many Koreans through the decades? What do you feel when you hear this?
I think it's a very haunting tune. And it reminds me really of the natural beauty of Korea. Kind of the pine trees and the rugged mountains that exist in the north of South Korea. And it's a picture I have in my mind.
Sounds like it's a pretty good picture, a memorable one.
Yes.
Sandra Nathan is a retired civil rights and labor lawyer who lives in Steventown, New York. She's been telling us about the COVID-19 survival box she received from the South Korean government, a thank you gift for serving in the Peace Corps more than five decades ago. Sandra, great to meet you. Thank you for telling us your story.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for inviting me too.
A legend in the soccer world died today, Argentine footballer Diego Maradona at the age of 60. Maradona is widely considered one of the greatest players of all time. The height of his career was in 1986 when he led Argentina to the World Cup. Maradona scored two of the most iconic goals in history in the same game against England. The first became known as the Hand of God, where Maradona leaps up and seems to punch the ball into the goal.
The England players protesting to the referee.
It happened in a blink of an eye. Did Maradona use his head or his hand to score? The referees did not call the penalty. The second goal was later voted the goal of the century. Maradona dribbles the ball halfway down the field, faking out one British defender after another, leading the announcer to exclaim, "Thank you, God, for football for Maradona." Maradona's fame only grew when he played for high-profile European teams in Barcelona and Naples. But the Argentine soccer star struggled with fame and alcohol addiction throughout his life. Diego Maradona died today of cardiac arrest in his home in Buenos Aires. A sad day for Argentines and for soccer fans all over the globe. You count on the world's journalists to get to the bottom of every story. Who we are matters because we bring our full selves to this job, which has a direct impact on the reporting. If you have a moment, we'd like you to meet us. See who we are behind the microphones. Visit theworld.org/whoweare. Again, that's theworld.org/whoweare. You're listening to The World. A reminder to listeners, The World is free for anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. We report stories from around the globe with nuance, context, and by listening to the voices of the people most affected by the news. Donate to The World today to support the work of our superhero staff and help us keep our coverage free and open to all. You can help keep the show accessible to everybody across the globe by donating $100. That's just $8.33 a month. Help us make our goal and you'll receive an invite to a virtual party with the incredible people who make this show possible. To give, visit theworld.org/whoweare or follow the link right here in the episode notes. Stay safe. Stay healthy, and thank you. In Beirut, many Lebanese are struggling. So are stray cats and dogs.
You know, you're trying to accommodate the large number of dogs, especially when it rains. And it's raining today, and I hate when it rains. It's terrible.
A Beirut animal shelter fighting to find ways to care for orphan pets. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A Russian brokered peace deal between Armenia and Azerbaijan is holding steady. The countries fought for 6 weeks over the territory of Nagorno-Karabakh. It's a contested area. It's part of Azerbaijan, but it's been under Armenia's control since the 1990s when the two nations fought a bloody war. This time, though, Armenia was on the losing side. Under the terms of the peace agreement, a region called Kelbajar was handed back to Azerbaijani forces today. Reporter Andrew Connolly paid the region a visit just before the handover.
This primary school is a mess. Textbooks, laminated posters of equations, and photos of smiling students are scattered on the wooden floor. And on the wall hang some colourful pencil doodles of houses and animals. And through the window next to them, I can see flames licking up a house next door that's slowly burning to the ground. The region of Kelbajar was under Armenian occupation since 1994. Today it's due to be handed back to Azerbaijan. A woman looking around the school, who doesn't want to give me her name, tells me why people are setting fire to their homes here.
We saw some videos of Azerbaijanis entering the houses of Armenians, and they started ruining everything inside. And that's why Armenians are burning their own houses, so that that won't happen. Some people are even removing their families' gravestones from the cemeteries, because we don't know what they'll do with them.
When war erupted in and around the Nagorno-Karabakh region on the 27th of September, many Armenians had to flee their homes quickly, with no time to take much with them. On a dusty road, animal charity worker Hrant Devoyan opens the rear door of a van full of puppies.
We are here, this is the second time we're coming to rescue as many dogs as we can because they've been abandoned. And now we're going to try to do the for the adoption. And if not, they're going to stay in the shelters. And a lot of them, they're going to be adopted to U.S.
Armenia's economy was struggling even before the ravages of war and pandemic. But the atmosphere in Kelbajar is desperate. People are stripping floorboards, removing roof tiles, and cutting down trees, all to be sold at markets. A few demobilized soldiers on the side of the road shoot at electricity pylons to bring down the cables. During the war between the two countries in the late 80s, Azerbaijanis living in Kelbajar were driven from their homes. The Armenian government later gave the land to Armenian refugees who'd fled Azerbaijan. Alec Devizian, an accordion musician in the village club, was one of the recipients. Alec's car is stuffed full of bits of furniture, a mattress, some paintings, even some vines from his garden. For the second time in his life, war with Azerbaijan is forcing Alec to move. But despite this, he doesn't seem to mind who lives here after him, even the supposed enemy.
But I see he's not burning his house, no? Why is that?
No.
Why not?
Inchu?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay, yes, he said that I build it and I cannot do it now. Like, I build it by my own hands, I don't want to burn it. Let it be, I don't care who will leave, Turk or Azeri, I will leave my house.
Several miles away, perched in a valley surrounded by mountains crowned by wisps of clouds, sits the Dedevank Monastery. Built between the 9th and 13th century, the burial site of ancient saints, and adorned by medieval frescoes and crosses, it's one of the most significant symbols in Armenia's Christian heritage. In recent weeks, Armenians have been flocking here to light candles and attend services, heartbroken that the complex could be transferred to Azerbaijani control. The mood is somber. Armen Minassian is a student in New York City, but was visiting family in Armenia when the war broke out.
Why did you come here today?
I came to say goodbye to Daddy Wang and to say goodbye to this region. We call it Karvajar, but the first call it Kelvajar. And this is the second region that we're going to give to them. And it's very sad.
Though the Kelvajar region will be transferred to Azerbaijan, Russian peacekeepers are here to protect the monastery, and the priests should be allowed to stay. The setting is quite surreal because of the presence of tanks, jeeps and gun-toting Russian soldiers surrounding the area. One of the priests, Father Movzas, tells me he's glad the Dadivank will be protected, but is deeply concerned for the thousands of other churches in regions now captured by Azerbaijan.
What can I say? This monastery was important and significant place for pilgrimages. That's why this got more attention than the others. But every single church is important for us. It's the evidence that Armenians been living here long, long time.
As dusk sets in, the last few departing visitors take selfies with the priests, some of whom are wearing camouflage jackets. Russian soldiers help carry boxes of tinned food and pasta into the monastery. Muslim Azerbaijanis and Christian Armenians lived side by side in relative peace in the days of the Soviet Union, but since its collapse, they've violently clashed and vandalized each other's holy sites. Though Russia now presides over a fragile peace, big questions remain over how to repair decades of hatred and prevent the region descending once again into war. For the world, I'm Andrew Connolly, Kelbajar, Azerbaijan.
For years, a charity that looks after lost and abandoned pets in Lebanon has been struggling to stay on its feet. A pandemic, the economic crisis, and a bomb blast this summer at the port of Beirut made things even more difficult. Now, 850 dogs, 150 cats, some horses and donkeys are facing an uncertain future. Dozens of dogs barking there, in a video taken by the folks at Beta, that's Beirut for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Helena Husseini is the vice president of Beta and runs a dog shelter in Beirut. Helena, it's kind of extraordinary in a country with a reputation for corruption that deeply affects its human population. You've been able to maintain the shelter for animals in Lebanon. How has that been possible? Do you have loyal donors?
We have loyal donors, but it's more because of the international donors that we're getting. We had some private donors who helped out and the SPCA International, especially the last 2 years. The local donors are not as many as before because, you know, what's happening in Lebanon, people are losing their money. They cannot get to their money. They are losing their jobs. The way of life in Lebanon has changed a lot. When you go to the supermarket, you see there's a big difference.
In what sense? What about dog and cat food?
Dog and cat food, now it's becoming so expensive. Let me give you an example. One bag of 15 kilos, about 30 pounds. Now the good quality food is 800,000 Lebanese pounds.
Wow. That's $520. That is amazing. That is extraordinary. Then the deadly August 4th explosion at the port happened. It killed some 200 people. We know a lot of animals were affected. They were orphaned. There were ones already in the streets. How many more animals did you take in at the shelter after the August 4th explosion?
Okay, we took in about 3 cats from people's animals who didn't want to take them back, and 5 dogs. But there are about 100 dogs as strays on the port. We took 42 of them. And the rest, we still take care of them. We spayed and neutered the females and the males. We vaccinated them. We go almost every other day to check on them. We give the food for the guys who work there, who like them.
When you walk into the shelter right now, what does it look like?
When you come, you have the welcome committee, which is like about 30, 40 dogs running towards you, jumping, being happy. But because we reached over capacity and we had to extend the shelter outside the wall, so you have like fences, like we have to cover for the rain with some banners that they use for publicities. And we try to make it till we move to the new place. And it looks a bit like the favela in Brazil, you know.
So you've reached capacity at the shelter, but that's not the only reason you're moving to a new property. In addition to everything else, you're facing an eviction. Why is that, given what you're doing for the animals?
In 2006, when there were the war, we moved to this facility, which was an abandoned pig farm, and we arranged it with the okay from the owner. He doesn't live in Lebanon. And 2.5 years ago, he wanted to sell the land, and he gave us 2 months to leave the place. But we couldn't in 2 months, you know, move 850 dogs. It's impossible. He didn't want to wait. That's why he pressed charges against us, and we are being evicted. So we have till January to manage to finish the construction and to move out.
Helena, have you ever had a dog at the shelter that you become so attached to, you adopted them?
Oh, yeah. That's why I have 10 dogs. I have 10 dogs, but at the shelter, I have my group of dogs. We all have our group of dogs. We have like 10, 15 dogs that are always following us. We love them all. They're our babies.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Helena Husseini runs the Beta Shelter in Beirut, which stands for Beirut for Ethical Treatment of Animals. Helena, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for caring for these animals.
Thank you so much for everything.
In Canada, health authorities say they are determined to protect nursing home residents from a second wave of coronavirus infections. In most of Canada, long-term care facilities are now off limits to everyone, except for staff and family members who provide essential care. But as Anita Elash reports from Toronto, that has taken another kind of toll, and some residents want the rules to change.
Devora Greenspan has lived in a nursing home in Toronto for almost 10 years. She's kept herself busy with university courses, running a seniors advocacy group, and visits with her daughter every Saturday.
We'd go out for lunch and we'd sit and chat and laugh and giggle. And then we'd walk the mall. We wouldn't buy anything. We just looked. And of course, we hugged. We're a very huggy family. We just had a great time. And I really miss that.
That all ended in March, when the Ontario government closed nursing homes to pretty much everyone but staff. Greenspan is 88 and gets around on her own. When other residents tested positive for coronavirus, she was moved to an isolation unit and confined to her room.
It was devastating. It was heartbreaking. It was horrifying. I was told I can't go past the doorway and to please keep my door shut for infection control. So I was in this little room with the door shut for 3 months. I nearly went out of my caretaker's mind.
A new report from British Columbia suggests that many nursing home residents, people like Devora Greenspan, are suffering both mentally and physically from ongoing lockdowns.
We found some very unintended consequences.
Isabel McKenzie is the seniors advocate in British Columbia. It's an office that helps seniors and advises the government on senior services. During the fall, McKenzie helped survey thousands of nursing home residents and their families.
There was a recurring theme, I'd rather die of COVID than live, not being able to hold my spouse's hand ever again.
McKenzie says that health authorities have lost sight of what residents want. She says most people only live in long-term care for about 18 months before they die. Since March, about 4,500 nursing home residents in British Columbia died of something other than COVID-19, compared to 150 deaths related to the coronavirus.
We need to take a look at what are we really trying to achieve here, because we are keeping our residents safe, relatively speaking, from COVID-19. We're not keeping them safe from dying, though.
McKenzie says there's a balance to strike here between the risk of COVID-19 and the risk to a resident's health from a long family separation. That makes sense to Diana Green.
I think with the family visits, they're going too far.
Green is 57 and has multiple sclerosis. She's in better health than most of her fellow residents at a nursing home in Cranbrook, B.C., When the pandemic started, she asked people there if they'd be willing to see their families, if that meant they'd be at risk of getting infected with the coronavirus.
And they all said that they'd rather die than not see their families. If that meant getting COVID, then so be it. But, and you got to remember, they've only got how many years left, right? So to them, they know they don't have long. They want to see their families.
Green's nursing home allowed limited family visits over the summer. But with the second wave of the pandemic, the rules are much stricter now. Family visits are supervised and have to take place in a common area. People still aren't allowed to touch.
I see a lot of anger. I see a lot of depression. People that just won't talk anymore. And I've had days too where I've felt really down, you know, thinking, when is this going to end?
Green told me that as far as she's concerned, people should be allowed to hug and touch, even if that increases the risk of a coronavirus infection. In Toronto, Devorah Greenspan is preparing to spend the holidays without her family. She says she doesn't want to get sick and doesn't want to give the coronavirus to anyone else.
I'm of two minds. I understand why they're doing it, but I don't like it. Let's put it that way. My head knows what they're doing is safe, but my heart doesn't agree. So
she says her wish for the holidays is that people who live in the community would stick to health guidelines and help flatten the curve so restrictions could be lifted for everyone. In BC, health officials say they're looking at how they can allow more visitors into long-term care facilities without increasing the risk from COVID-19. But as the number of cases in Canada increases, nursing homes remain in virtual lockdown for now. For The World, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
In Scotland, period products, tampons and pads, are now free to anyone who needs them. That's the promise the Scottish government just made. They're picking up the bill. Supporters of the measure offered research that stigma about menstruation and affordability of period products can be barriers for girls and women. Victoria Heaney is with Women for Independence, a grassroots group in Scotland. We spoke a couple of years ago when the campaign for free period products was gaining some early victories.
So I think we've still got a lot of normalisation to do when it comes to how we talk about periods, how we act around them, and how we talk to boys and men about them too. We all need to be educated on the same level about this.
Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon says Scotland is the only country in the world to make period products available free of charge. The bill passed Scottish Parliament last night in a convincing vote, 121-0. The Scottish government now needs to set up a system for where and how to make these products available. Here is something that's really great about 2020. Chess is cool, like super cool.
Start your clock.
The Queen's Gambit has become a worldwide hit on Netflix. The story follows the character Beth Harmon, an orphan who becomes a chess prodigy. The series has earned widespread praise for its authentic portrayal of the game. In part, you can attribute that to none other than Garry Kasparov. The Russian grandmaster and former world chess champion dominated international play for 2 decades and was a chess consultant for the Netflix series. He joins us now. Garry Kasparov, really great to have you with us to talk about this wonderful TV series, The Queen's Gambit. As a chess consultant, what did that entail? What was your job?
First, you know, we have to separate our functions with Bruce Pandolfini. I said, Bruce, you would ever think about America at early games. Beth Harmon played in Kentucky and in some U.S. tournaments. But I will concentrate on making sure that the games that will be shown at a higher level, so the top events, American National Championship, and of course, you know, the games with the Soviet players, that these games will be of a perfect quality. Not just, you know, some positions at the chessboard, but real games, because I knew that many of these games will be shown, not in their entirety, but players, even just amateurs, will be able to look at the positions and identify whether it's serious or not. And I came up with a collection of games that were based on real games, but also I added some of the continuations that were analyzed with computer to make these games real. And I think it worked out, especially in the last game. I was quite proud that I developed a new game based on one of the professional game played in 1993 between two top players, Vasily Ivanchuk from Ukraine and American champion Patrick Wolf. And actually, Patrick immediately wrote me a message after the show was released saying, oh, I recognize the game.
So, Garry Kasparov, now that the series is out and you've seen it, do the chess matches feel real to you on screen?
It's not just the way they sat at the chessboard, the way they played the game, but also the atmosphere surrounding the chess matches. Because she faced Soviet champions, the Soviets who dominated the game. I thought it would be very important to show the difference between American individualism and the Soviet teamwork. And eventually, at the end, she actually succeeded in beating Borg in the adjourned game by receiving very valuable advice from New York City, from her American friends and colleagues.
It's interesting you mention that, because this is something that really emerges in the series, these kind of two different approaches to chess. I'm going to play this one clip. This is Benny speaking to Beth.
And you know why they're the best players in the world?
They have the best suits.
It's because they played together as a team, especially during adjournments. They help each other out. Us Americans, we work alone because we're all such individualists. We don't like to let anyone help us.
I mean, the point that Benny is making there to Beth is that the Soviets are very team-oriented. When a match takes a pause or an adjournment, the Russians work with their player who's on the board. Initially, in the series, Beth is very individualistic. So, Garry Kasparov, have you seen these different approaches, and do you ascribe to either approach?
Look, I grew up in the Soviet Union, so it was not just, you know, work together during games, but also it's like a shifting experience from one generation to another. That's why the Soviet chess school was unbeatable for several generations. And in America, the best example of individualism was Bobby Fischer. And while many believe that Beth Harmon was kind of the female version of Bobby Fischer, that's where the paths separated, because Fischer never accepted anyone's help. Even when he played a world championship match, he was always very suspicious of anyone working with him. Beth Harmon's final success is based very much on the teamwork.
There's also the presentation of chess culture in Soviet Russia in the series. One of the last episodes, there's this scene during the matches in Moscow. There's a messenger boy who kind of comes out from the hall where they're playing the game to a crowd outside the chess hall. And the crowd's following the match really closely in real time. And the kid announces that Harmon has just moved the piece. She's surrounded by increasingly larger crowds of fans as she's winning matches, women and men. Is this all a fair portrayal of Russian chess fandom at the time?
Absolutely. It's even when I played Anatoly Karpov, that's already mid-80s, we had huge crowds of people standing outside of the playing halls, because even at the big concert halls where we played, you know, that could bring in up to 2,000 people, they were not big enough to satisfy the demand. So that's why the big demonstration boards outside of the playing halls, they were quite normal in Russia. And chess players were always treated with utmost respect.
I mean, it's based on fiction, the series, but what would have been the impact of seeing a young American woman flying into Moscow and taking down the country's revered grandmasters one by one? Can you imagine what that would have done in the 60s?
I cannot imagine what would have done in the 60s, but in 1970, 71, and 72, Bobby Fischer crushed consecutively all the top Soviet players. And it had tremendous impact on Soviet chess. And I can tell you that most of people I knew, they were rooting for Fischer, believe it or not. So I don't know whether it was this some kind of protest against the system or Fischer's playing style, his energy, his dynamism. But Fischer had a massive, massive following in the Soviet Union.
So in the month or so since The Queen's Gambit came out, you've spoken with a lot of people about the show, about the series, but also more generally about chess, this game that you love, that so many people around the world love. How are you seeing this new wave of enthusiasm for the game? What stories have you been hearing from around the globe right now in the wake of The Queen's Gambit?
Chess gained tremendous popularity over the last few weeks, and I hope it will be the beginning of a new boom, especially among girls. I think the story of Beth Harmon will be great encouragement for parents and for talented girls to continue pursuing their goals in chess. And I can hardly overestimate the importance, positive impact of the series for the promotion of the game of chess worldwide. It's a series on chess that has been dominating Netflix almost every country in the world.
It's incredible. Garry Kasparov, chess master, world chess champion, and film consultant now. Thank you very much. It's great to speak with you.
Thank you for inviting me.
No matter how you plan to spend Thanksgiving, count on us to keep you company for an hour. A special edition of the show, Ethiopian-American musician Meklit Hadero joins me in a show we're calling Movement, an hour meeting four artists who talk about what home means to them and how their sense of home has changed in their music. That's tomorrow. And speaking of home, here's a pioneering psychedelic rock group from Istanbul. From the 1960s to today, Molar make music anywhere they get the chance. We'll be right back. Molar, take us out today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, smart, and careful the next few days. Hope you can make it here tomorrow.